And that brings up the final case of today, which is number 092099 and 09. I'm sorry, it's just 2099. The other case is here on Anders. This is United States versus Graham. There's a co-defendant in this case, Clarence Plato, but his case is being submitted on the briefs.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, Counsel. Your Honors, we have raised two issues where we believe that Mr. Graham was denied a fair trial. The first is the fact that he was tried with his co-defendant, Mr. Plato. The second is that during that trial, the jury during deliberations was shown for the first time selected portions of surveillance video in slow motion. Now, there were two problems. Well, I shouldn't say two problems. There's one problem with their interrelated with trying Mr. Graham and Mr. Plato together. The first part of that is that their defenses were irreconcilable. Mr. Plato's entire defense in this matter was that he was with Mr. Graham at the time and the place of the crime, and that, yes, indeed, Mr. Graham committed this crime, but only Mr. Graham alone committed this crime, and that he, Mr. Plato, was an innocent bystander. The jury, with that defense, is placed in the situation to believe Mr. Plato, they would have to convict Mr. Graham. Now, the second part of the problem with trying Mr. Graham and Mr. Plato together was the conduct of Mr. Plato's attorney, Mr. Knoll. Now, it's inescapable, and no one, I don't believe, can argue the fact that Mr. Knoll took on the role of a second prosecutor against Mr. Plato in this case. And he did it with zealousy.
Not against Mr. Plato, Mr. Graham.
I'm sorry, Mr. Graham. Thank you, Judge. Your Honor. He went out, prosecuting Mr. Graham.
It's a prosecutor's dream, you know.
And a defendant's worst nightmare, Your Honor.
Two defendants, each one says the other one committed the crime, and the prosecutor says they're both right.
In this case, though, Your Honor, Mr. Graham did not say that Mr. Plato committed this crime. He didn't know, you know, if a crime had been committed, and if it had, who had actually committed the crime. Now, the biggest problem in this case with Mr. Knoll's conduct and his prosecution of Mr. Graham was that his conduct was completely unrestrained. From the beginning of this trial, he made numerous inappropriate, inflammatory, and unfairly prejudicial comments about Mr. Graham to the jury.
Did Mr. Graham's counsel ever move to sever based upon antagonistic defenses?
No, Judge.
Okay. And, of course, the trial judge, once the government agreed not to use the statements, the sole ground sought for severance was there. And the trial judge at that point would have had no idea how Mr. Plato's attorney intended to conduct his defense, let's say. At least he wouldn't have known it was so aggressive.
Correct, Judge.
It's kind of hard to say the trial judge erred in failing to grant a motion for severance on grounds that weren't offered and which weren't even apparent at the time the issue came up.
Well, I can't explain the conduct of the defense attorney, even the prosecution, in this particular case. But our argument is that at least at the end of closing, I mean, of opening statements, when it became apparent what the Knoll's case was going to be and how aggressively he was going to try to prosecute Mr. Graham, what his defense of Mr. Plato was going to be, and the inflammatory statements that he had said during opening statements, that at that point in time, certainly the defense should have raised it and asked for severance. And if not the defense, then maybe even the prosecution to protect their record or the judge on their own should have called counsel up and said, we need to sever these trials.
Well, there isn't a sua sponte duty for the judge to raise that. And the law is that if the motion isn't made at the close of the evidence, it's a waiver, not just a forfeiture.
I understand what the Honor is stating with regards to if it's a waiver if it's not made at the close of evidence. It's our argument, though, that this is such a fundamental right, one, to a fair trial. Two, there were very specific trial words that were violated by Mr. Knoll in this case. One, he made statements to the jury alluding to the honesty of his client. He talked about how honest his client, how forthright his client was. He put out his client's statements, or his theory of the case. I shouldn't say statements, his theory of the case, that, yes, he was with Mr. Graham at the time of the scene. Mr. Graham committed this crime.
Right, but the jury is instructed that what counsel says isn't evidence, et cetera, right?
They certainly are. I believe in this case, I just don't think an instruction could cure the problem. That, in fact, that the jury was told this story under this veil, this cloak of authority by Mr. Knoll, that because his client was there, that what he was saying was true, that Mr. Graham had committed this crime, but yet Mr. Graham was not afforded the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Plato. I think that is a direct violation of Mr. Graham's Sixth Amendment right to confront his accusers. And it's also, I believe, his specific right to be tried only on the facts that are presented at trial.
I didn't read a Sixth Amendment argument in this case.
It's laid out, Judge, in both of our briefs.
That there was a Sixth Amendment violation by the co-defendant's counsel?
Well, that our counsel was denied his Sixth Amendment right, Judge, because he wasn't allowed to confront
the attorney?
I understand, Judge, but it wasn't that he wasn't allowed to confront the attorney, Judge. He wasn't allowed to confront Mr. Plato. And Mr. Knoll was... I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
His statements didn't come in.
No, but his attorney offered them as if he had testified. I mean, he talked about how honest his client was, and then
There's a camera that showed up there. It'd be kind of silly to say your guy wasn't with him.
That is true, Your Honor.
So he was with him. Everybody agrees to that. That's what he said.
They do agree that he was with him. But what he does state is under this, I keep using this cloak of authority because he's speaking for his client, that he was there. Yes, he was there, and Mr. Graham committed this crime.
That's not an admission. That's an acknowledgment that the facts show. The camera clearly shows they're together.
But the
camera doesn't say what you're complaining about. That's what he says. He was only a bystander. He was only the patsy. This guy is the guy that committed the crime.
Correct.
But he's not a witness, and the jury's told he's not a witness, and what the lawyer says is not evidence, is not to be considered evidence. They were carefully instructed. But your theory is it's so bad there's no way of correcting the problem.
That is my theory, Judge. I think that if co-defendants are in a situation where one of the co-defendants is going to argue under this, by almost presenting in this particular case that he was testifying as if it was his client had testified, if he was giving arguments as if his client had testified, then those cases need to be severed.
Well, there was evidence to support the argument. I mean, the confidential informant testified, who was no longer confidential, and said Graham was the one that gave me the cocaine, and Graham was the one I gave the money to, and then the money was found in Graham's girlfriend's purse. So when does it become arguing what his client would have said and arguing based on the evidence that this is what occurred and my client was not involved?
To answer Your Honor, the issue here, though, is we're dealing with the fundamental right and we're dealing with the Sixth Amendment. And under those situations, the guilt or innocence of Mr. Graham is not at issue. If, in fact, his fundamental right to a fair trial was violated, if, in fact, he wasn't provided the protection of the Sixth Amendment, whether or not he was guilty or innocent actually doesn't apply into that review.
Any rebuttal time? I just thought I'd let you know. You're going to save a little for rebuttal. You better sit down now.
Yes, Judge, I'll save a little for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Cox.
Morning again, Your Honors. Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. I've been doing this for a long time, and I've tried an awful lot of joint defendant cases, and as those cases go, this is one of the tamer trials, at least in my reading of the record, in terms of the defendants. There was Mr. Graham, the defendant who's complaining about prejudice. The exact same evidence would have been introduced had he been tried separately. Every piece of evidence.
What wouldn't have been there is his co-defendant's lawyer saying, yeah, my guy was only the patsy, and he's the
Well, they both sort of said that, Your Honor. They were both pointing the finger at each other. Mr. Graham says I was innocent.
Did Plato testify?
Plato did not testify. His
lawyer, he didn't say it.
His lawyer, certainly his the lawyer's defense, because Mr. Plato did not testify or offer any evidence whatsoever.
So when you said that, it's not quite true. It's that Graham said it. Plato said it through his lawyer.
Correct.
Yeah.
In terms of the finger pointing at each other.
Yeah. Mr. Plato, that's what his beef is.
Right.
The lawyer's not subject to cross-examination.
But there was nothing that the lawyer said. Well, as Judge Sykes said, first off, the jury was told any number of times that the statements of lawyers are not evidence. And the only evidence of Mr. Plato's theory of the defense came from the very videotapes and the audio tapes that were introduced into evidence. His theory was, you heard these tapes, and he sort of ignored the tapes about setting up the drug deal. But he said
his lawyer's name should have been Aristotle to make this whole thing round.
Well, he had a novel theory that you couldn't be guilty of the crime unless you were the one who physically handed the drugs. And, of course, that was certainly not supported by the instructions that the jury was given by the judge. But that was his theory. He stuck with it from his opening all the way through his closing, was that essentially my guy was in the car. He doesn't say a word. He's not the one who gets the money, and he's not, according to the confidential source, the one who physically hands the drugs to the confidential source. Therefore, he's not guilty. That was his argument the whole way. And then the other flip side of that was Mr. Graham is the one who's guilty because he's the one who physically handed the drugs, and he got the money.
One thing that's important is it's obvious the jury didn't believe that Plato's lawyer anyway.
Correct. He got convicted. Mr. Graham was convicted. Mr. Graham had the opportunity, of course, to testify and fully explain his theory of why he was not guilty of a crime to the jury, and the jury disregarded it.
Yeah, so the more important thing is they certainly ignored what the defense lawyer said on behalf of Plato, and they brought in a guilty at him, too. So.
Correct.
And you agreed in advance of trial not to use the cross-inculpating statements, which took the constitutional issue off the table.
We did. Because I think was stated in our motion, we didn't feel it was necessary. And I don't know the specific how good the pretrial statements were that Mr. Plato gave to law enforcement, but they certainly weren't any better than the videotapes and the audio tapes, which clearly showed that he was a participant in the crime, and we wanted to try the case together.
Anything else?
Not often the government gives up good evidence, but in this case, we certainly did.
Good.
Anything on slow motion?
Well, my opponent didn't bring it up, so I didn't know it was appropriate to comment on it. But I find that I don't know what is wrong with having the jury closely examine evidence. That's what we do all the time. And
I think you tell them to do it closely, examine the evidence.
Correct. And I think in this case, Judge Scott explained it probably the most succinctly.
They get to see it in better context if they can do it in slow motion.
Right. Well, and I can't see anything without my glasses, so I suppose if I can't use my glasses, I would be handicapped in the same way. So if I can slow it down and see it better, it seems to me that aids the truth-seeking process as opposed to impeding it.
Every now and then a lawyer talks too fast, too, you know, so you have to slow them down a bit.
That's true, too.
You don't have that problem.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, then I would yield back the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Mr. Harvey. You have a minute and a half left.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I want to go right to the slow motion video. Judge, it is our argument that in this particular case, that presenting the slow motion video was tantamount to new evidence. I think it's clear under common sense and an individual life experience, as well through the scientific studies which we provided this court, that images shown in slow motion have a different effect than if they are shown in regular time. Well, not just that, Judge. You have an emotional response, a psychological response to that. And the images that you see are different. Maybe it is just so you can see them better. But our only point is, okay, if you can see them better, present it during the trial so at least the defense has the opportunity to confront that evidence, confront how the jury is going to see it, confront how the jury is going to perceive that, and confront how the emotional response the jury is going to have. All we're asking is that if you're going to show video in slow motion, we're not arguing you can't show video in slow motion. We're just simply saying it's got to be done during the trial and not just during deliberations. The defense should have the opportunity to confront that evidence before the jury deliberates upon that evidence.
Motion.
In slow motion, Judge.
What
yes.
do you mean the defense in slow motion?
Well, if the video is played in slow motion, the defense should have the opportunity then to review and confront that with the jury, the effect that slow motion will have.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I don't know if that would be very effective.
What would you have done?
In this particular case, I think that the judge should not have allowed them to review it in slow motion. Simple. It wasn't presented in slow motion during the trial. Why should they get to look at it in slow motion during deliberations?
But is there any argument that you were prejudiced by the fact that he did that? In other words, I think Judge Sykes was asking, if it had been shown in slow motion during the trial, what difference would it have made?
Well, Judge, we don't know what difference it would have made, but we do know that it was important because the jury thought it was important because the jury asked to see it in slow motion. So we know that it was something that the jury considered and they thought it was important. So if the jury thought it was important and they convicted, then I would argue to the court that yes, that it did prejudice my client. I'd also argue to the fact, Judge, because the Seventh Circuit has not really issued a decision on whether or not slow motion video that isn't played during the trial should be allowed to be played during deliberations. And it's our argument that it is per se an abuse of discretion to let any jury review evidence, video evidence in slow motion for the first time during deliberations if it's not presented to the jury during the actual trial.
All right. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Harvey, you were appointed in this case?
Yes.
All right. You have the thanks of the court for your efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
Vigorous efforts.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning.